Mini episode 147 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by The Sports Train, the finest pure sports talk show on both terrestrial and internet radio. Follow them on the web at thesportstrain.net.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome to part 1B of the History of SummerSlam series with Kyle Ross. Kyle Ross and yours truly, Rick Morris, coming at you here to go through the history of SummerSlam. This first block, the ones, if you will, 88 to 92. We're going to be knocking off in this one, time permitting, and I think we will be able to, 89 and 90. And we laid out some of the shortcomings of 88 when we were going through it. You can go back and check that out in mini episode 146. But here in 147, looking at this card, again, we used the term glorified house show as we did for the first WrestleMania. That applied to the first SummerSlam. And again, SummerSlam 89, not a very program-heavy show up and down the card, but there were at least the glimmers. It was a good work rate show. There were things in there, characters, I think, that we connected with to a fairly decent degree watching it. So while it still wasn't up to the standards of today, as far as everything is there for a good reason, there was a lot that would keep you entertained.
Yeah, and, you know, there were, unlike 88, which was completely bereft of any programs, There was a very well-built-to Intercontinental title match that was a huge blow-off. You had some tag team feuds underneath that were good. The Rockers, Rougeaus was a good program. You talked about six-mans in the last episode.
Yeah.
You had what they did on this show is they took two pretty hot feuds, Tito Santana against Rick Martel and the Rockers against the Rougeaus.
Did the Rockers and Rougeaus have a pretty good program?
Yeah.
Okay.
There was an angle that's often forgotten where the Rockers, and it was completely done to set up this program, the Rockers sang over their theme song and the Rougeaus thought they were copying and they beat them up over
okay,
it, if you remember.
Okay.
It was a pretty hot feud. If you remember, they had some really good matches on the European tour.
Okay.
The one in London, one in Paris. I think they both were commercially released. I've seen the one in France. I don't think I ever saw the one in London. Maybe I have. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
They're both equally as good. But you have that fused together, and you had some other stuff. Now, there were still some dogs, and what kind of, in the production notes, what I noted to you, what kind of taints the show is Zeus, his existence, It was weird because in retrospect, they never did a Hogan-Zeus one-on-one match. Now, In retrospect, thank God they didn't, because that would have been atrocious. But if you're going to go all in like that on a feud, and they did make a big deal about that. I mean, that was their big summer feud, if you remember. Hogan, from what happens in 88, obviously, from 88, the Mega Powers break up. Hogan beats Savage for the title. There's some residual from Hogan and Savage. But Savage goes into a feud with Brutus Beefcake, who was doing the best work of his career at that point. And
damning with faint praise.
Yeah. Well, he actually was. He had a very good match with Randy Savage on the Saturday night's main event that set this match up.
Past lounge guest, Weekid.
Yeah.
No, he could be carried to decent matches.
Yeah, he could.
Yeah.
But the big, big post-Mania thing they did was the introduction of Zeus. No Holds Barred was released into theaters, which I understand they're now burying, by the way.
Yeah.
If I read that correctly. And Zeus came out on a Saturday night's main event when Hogan had the famous cage match against the Boss Man on Saturday night's main event and beat him up. And so, because Zeus is not fondly remembered for obvious reasons, people are like, Zeus was in the main event of the show. This is kind of bad. And while it's, again, kind of an underwhelming tag team main event on the show, the undercard, particularly compared to 88, offers you a lot more here.
Just the fact that Hogan Zeus, after they did this here, reprised the tag match in a cage months later on pay-per-view along with the movie. Just the fact that Hogan Zeus still at that point was on the short list of possible WrestleMania six matches is enough to make you want to vomit.
That's true.
They didn't learn their lesson from these two matches when they killed it.
Yeah, they didn't. Well, the thing is, when the problem was, and it's a fair move, at first you could not possibly put Zeus in by himself to work a match. I mean, you had to have it worked okay with Savage as his tag team partner because Savage would do 90% of the work.
Right.
And, you know, you gave Savage a foe and Beefcake. They had the kind of, remember the scary Sherry thing on
right.
Brother Love that Savage and Beefcake did. That was an okay feud. But, again, those were kind of ancillary parts to the Hogan-Zeus feud, which just, yeah, thankfully, cooler heads prevailed. They did not do it at WrestleMania 6 because that was discussed at one point. That's why you didn't have that as the headline match. They thought, and by they, I mean Vince, because no other reasonable-minded person could possibly think this, that, oh, you know, we could stretch this Hogan-Zeus thing out and headline WrestleMania.
Oh.
That would have, which, thank God, you know, I've never been so thankful to see Jim Hellwig in a ring.
Yeah.
And he's, by the way, second year in a row, he's the MVP of this event, in my opinion.
Really? Okay, well.
I thought in 88, we talked about it, I thought that was the most memorable part of that show, him winning the Intercontinental title from the Honky Tonk Man.
Okay.
And him winning the title back from Rick Rude. Is clearly the highlight of this show.
Yeah, 1602, he wins the Intercontinental title back. But in just talking about the main event for a second here, I mentioned to you off air, I found this card to be reminiscent of another time, specifically because it had Hogan at the top of the card, minus the fact that there weren't a lot of programs to the undercard. In some ways, when you're talking about the work rate on the undercard, it felt like a WCW card 7, 8, 9 years later where Hogan was on top, if you remember that, and the main events would be brutal. But the undercard stuff, because you had, you know, the cruiserweights and everything else
it
like
wasn't
that,
quite
were pretty
as,
kick-ass.
Yeah, I mean,
This was still 80s work rate, so there's a ceiling on 80s work rate versus 90s work rate. But for the time, the work rate on this show, on the undercard, was really good.
Yeah, I mean, there's three of the first five matches or four or five matches on the show are very good matches.
Brainbuster's Heart Foundation, enough said.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of weird. I didn't like, I thought it was kind of handicapped somewhat by the non-title gimmick. That made no
sense. That was
like,
kind of weird.
To have a babyface team,
yeah,
just because it goes against the principles.
Yeah.
The Hearts were babyfaces. It was a non-title. The Busters had just beaten Demolition, ending their long run as champions. Right before this show, like 3 weeks, and this match had already been signed.
Right.
And for some reason, they decided, oh, you know what, we're going to honor a non-title gimmick. And it was weird because the Hearts didn't go over. And to me, you never have a babyface team lose a non-title match.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. Now, that's not to take away from the match because it was they were doing a lot of great stuff. It was almost, dare I say, NWA-ish.
It was.
Because they were given time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, during this time period, the tag, those NWA, as it became WCW, particularly in 1990, the undercards were dominated by tag team matches.
Yeah.
And this was as, you know, good as most of those. I thought this was a four-star match, Hearts and Busters.
Brett in his book said he thought that the booking of this one was pretty strange. We've had both Brett and Tully.
He did. He agreed with me.
Had both Brett and Tully on the show. Brett three times now. So subsequently, when Brett's back, we'll have to ask him about this program here. And same with Tully.
The thing is, there was no reason for this to be not be a title match.
No, there shouldn't have been.
There would have been more heat to it. It would have only helped. I mean, the Hearts shouldn't have won.
Right.
But if they're not going to win, might as well make it a title match.
No, exactly. Kind of a throwaway, but this was the debut of Dusty Rhodes on WWF pay-per-view as he wrestled the Honky Tonk Man as he was going through the horn here. But when you're talking about the other matches on this thing that were really good, obviously we talk about, you know, the occasional swank six bands that you would see on these shows here. Martel, the pre-model at this show, and the Rougeaus against Tito and the Rockers.
Love this match.
Six of the best workers in the company.
Yeah, I mean, that's very rare that during this time period you could put six guys in a 1989 WWF ring and have none of them be bad.
That's true. But here's what I find to be
three and three-quarter stars.
Here's what I find to be very odd. All right, you're not protecting, as we go back to the Honky Tonk Man. All right, he's working his way down the card. He's doing the favors back, whatever. That match gets 9:36. Kurt Hennig and Terry Taylor get 3:21. In what universe should
Taylor
Dusty
got
Rhodes?
Hurt. Taylor got
oh,
hurt.
Okay.
Taylor
okay.
gets hurt.
Okay,
yeah,
okay,
Taylor,
okay, okay. My
at least
bad.
That's the story. I mean, I'm not a physician.
My bad.
I am not a physician.
Because there's guys that could go 15 minutes and go M-O-Y-T-C possibly, but that's...
Well, not with that Red Rooster gimmick.
No, not with the Red Rooster. No, the gimmick was limiting, but Terry Taylor was an excellent worker.
He was.
Kurt Hennig, enough
said.
I believe
the story is... And if you watch, because they do end it very abruptly.
Okay.
They're going pretty fast-paced.
All right.
They go out of the ring. I think Taylor blew out his knee in that match,
ooh,
which is why it was short.
Right,
Taylor blew out his knee and was really never the same, I don't think, to be honest. So
no,
that's why. Because if you watch it, he perfect plaque. It's like over, like really quick in the blink of an eye. But Dusty Honky still, for that was a glorified squash.
Right.
And Honky, you know, lost the title the previous SummerSlam, had basically spent the entire year doing jobs back for everybody in the promotion. So,
that
made sense. It got Dusty over, and Honky still had kind of a name.
You explained the booking on that to me. The only other question I have on any other match of any note, 627, why does Ted DiBiase defeat Jimmy Snuka by countout? Why does Jimmy Snuka have to be protected at this point?
Snuka was kind of... First of all, maybe people do say this, but I don't think it's said enough. Jimmy Snuka's second WWF run was hideous.
It was.
He was bad. But I think the reason they did countout here, and again, we talk about in 88 not doing programs... DiBiase's big program was with Jake Roberts, but Jake, I can't remember if he was injured or was in legal trouble during this time.
Legal.
Okay. And so he wasn't around. If you remember, they had DiBiase injure him in the spring of 89.
Right.
And Jake came back a couple months after this, because DiBiase even says something to Jake Roberts, like, I ran Jake Roberts out of professional wrestling, or it's before this match. But Snuka had come back post-WrestleMania. So this is to answer your question. Mm-hmm. He'd come back post-WrestleMania, and they thought, you know, Jimmy Snuka was a huge star in like 84, you know, 83, 84, 85, that period, the early 80s. They're like, oh, he's going to be a big name. And it became pretty obvious pretty early that he wasn't very good anymore, that drugs had taken their toll. You know,
they also booked him like just another guy. That's part of it, too.
Well, I mean, again, you know, he got... I think
Billy Graham got a bigger push coming back than Jimmy Snuka did. Let's be honest.
Well, maybe he just sucked that bad. I'm trying to remember. I mean, I remember he wrestled against Boris Zukov on a Saturday Night's Main Event. I remember really looking forward to that when I was a kid. Like, oh, Jimmy Snuka. Like, because I was, you know, I'm a little younger than you.
Yeah.
I was too young to, like, really grasp Snuka in his heyday.
Okay.
So I had seen, you know, the video. I was like, oh, Jimmy Snuka, this is cool. And he did the splash and we crushed Boris Zukov. And then he got here, and I think they had kind of begun to realize, oh, God, this guy's bad. He botches like a leapfrog in this match. So I think, and, you know, they didn't like the job anyone unless if they were in the honky-tonk man position where they had no use for you anymore.
All right, okay.
So that's probably why DiBiase should have gone over. You know, nowadays they wouldn't do a count-out. They wouldn't protect Snuka at all. They would have him lose.
Greatest thing ever, and backing up a little bit here, after Snuka left, a couple months later or whenever it was, they did the thing. The Superfly music comes on. It's C.V. Oppy, and the crowd just shiznits on it like there's no tomorrow. That was the greatest thing ever, the failed replacement of Jimmy Snuka with C.V. Oppy.
Yeah, that was bad. And we should also note, too, talk about guys, once again, to build off 88, not working their program. They're doing the house show.
Right.
Snuka was working with Honky Tonk Man around this.
Yeah, remember they did a guitar shot.
They did a guitar shot thing, and you know that didn't work for either guy.
No, it didn't. And last thing we should mention, not because it was a great match, but some of the biggest names on the card were in this. Another six-man, sort of the reverse, or the bizarro world six-man on this. You had the greatness of work rate in the other match, and then you had this one, Jim Duggan and Demolition against the Twin Towers and Andre the Giant. So
yeah, this was sort of residual. Andre, if you remember, had thrown the chair in to the Brainbusters on Saturday Night's Main Event.
Okay.
To cause that, and that's what they're building up. Jim Duggan was King Duggan at this point.
That's right.
And the Twin Towers were just an ancillary part. They were just thrown in. I remember when I was a kid, it was kind of cool, like three really fat guys on a team.
And this is when Duggan was working the program with Andre, right? After he knocked him out with the 2x4?
No, that was the previous.
All right.
Jim Duggan had... He had no direction. He was the king. He had beaten Haku shortly after WrestleMania. And he was just a total transition thing.
He would
lose to Savage in a very forgotten program
after
this. But he was kind of just in his usual mid-card purgatory. The Twin Towers were obviously a big thing earlier in the year, you know, feuding with the Mega Powers. But once, you know, the Mega Powers broke up, they kind of had nothing for him to do.
Right.
And Akeem was, you know, they were kind of trying to figure ways to siphon Akeem off, I think.
Yeah.
But two totally different six-man tags on the show. But this is a huge upgrade over the 88 version. The Warrior-Rude match, seriously, is like a borderline 4.5-star match featuring kind of the return to Roddy Piper of TV. He had come back on primetime, if you remember, and done this feud with Rick Rude and he shows up here, moons Rick Rude.
Yeah.
You know, we can talk, and this is a great, this is Warrior's first great, first of like only three great matches he ever had, but this is exact, this is when the Intercontinental title meant something.
Right.
You know, Rude wins it at WrestleMania. Well, it's obvious he cheated. You have to do a big rematch. This is exactly how you build a title match blow-off program.
Exactly.
Exactly how.
Yeah, that is how. So, anything further on 89? The fact that it was an excellent undercard that kind of came to a screeching halt in the main event?
Yeah, your boy Ron Garvin made a bunch of unfunny jokes as ring announcer.
Well,
you know. Ron Garvin's, I don't want to hear anything. You can't, but Ron Garvin sucked in the WWF.
He was booked poorly. I'll admit that.
He sucked. He sucked.
He was booked very poorly. He was done no favors by the vengeful booking. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, because I'm sure they were. Yeah, all the money they were losing during the Ron Garvin title reign. Yes, I'm sure Vince was very upset about that.
Hey, Vince went out of his way to screw the Ron Garvin title defense at Starrcade '87. That's how much he feared having Ron Garvin on top of the other promotion.
Yeah. The only problem with that is that like six people still watch the match. I think, you know.
Yeah, pretty much. So all right, and looking at '89, yeah, excellent undercard. 90, very interesting because I don't know if we could extract from this the fact that that there was a more developed undercard vis-a-vis programs, but the next year, and I did not realize this until being apprised of it here relatively recently, and by relatively recently I mean 20 seconds ago on Wikipedia here, that there was a SummerSlam Fever that aired on USA Network leading up to the show, almost a Clash of the Champions kind of type thing to build interest for the show. So that must indicate that they had more developed programs the next year because I'm guessing that this was to advance some of those, perhaps?
Not really. It was a pretty, if you look at it, it was a pretty nothing show. I think it aired as Primetime Wrestling.
They used Ronnie Garvin to do a job to Mr. Perfect. That's a you know, Travis Sham mockery right there. But
well, yeah, Ron Garvin was still drawing a paycheck in August of 90. He was lucky, okay?
I'm looking at the other matches here, and you may have a point because I don't know how many of these were. It's funny because these are guys that were you talk about vengeance booking, guys that were names in other places. Black Bart, who is a name in world class,
God's
as
sakes.
He does a job of the Texas Tornado. The Warlord defeated Pez Watley. So it is very interesting. There was a lot of vengeance booking towards the old territories.
I'll tell you
on this
what, I think
here.
You're the only person interested in Pez Watley and Black Bart. Okay,
let me
right
tell you
now.
Something that you talk about something that a couple of my friends talk about to this day.
Oh.
The junkyard dog slap of Pez Watley when he went out there and beat, I don't remember who it was, on World Championship Wrestling.
Pistol Pez Watley is
Buzz
terrible.
Buzz Sawyer, I think.
Pistol Pez Watley is terrible. And knew his place, okay? Pistol Pez Watley should be gracious that he was allowed a job on SummerSlam Fever in the shank of the evening on USA Network, okay? Which at the time was one of 10 cable stations.
Exactly.
This was not a...
you're right.
I was
that.
Aware of it. It was not a major show.
This was not program
development.
The big
thing for 1990 is that they went away from the tag matches.
Right.
And they went to a double main event. And this is where I want to start, Ricky, reins here. They went to a double main event here. And it was so indicative. I've brought this up before on many podcasts with you and doing, in a previous life, doing SNS. I'm never going to say, and no one in their right mind would, that the Ultimate Warrior, in retrospect, could have ever been the champion Hulk Hogan was. There's just no way. But he was done no favors as champion.
Sure.
And this show was so indicative of the problem. Double main event. Hogan had the far more interesting program, and the obvious comeback is, well, you know, that's Hogan. He's better. Man, I have said it a million times, probably, doing stuff with you, that... Hogan got all the attention after that match. You know, Hogan like said, "Oh, everyone just wanted to look at me." Well, they spent most of the match talking about how Hulkster's going to live in. It's classic Hogan. He does the law. He does the job, but he get the five times he jobs. You know, he still makes sure the focus, the promotion is on him.
Well, that was impromptu when he went back in the ring to put the belt on him. He did that to draw sympathy. He was
for himself.
For himself.
It was a very selfish move.
Yes, it
now,
was.
Now it worked. It was cool. But here's the thing. And that's fine. I had no problem with the way WrestleMania 6 ended at all. But after that, they really needed to get Hogan out of the way for the Warrior.
Right.
Now, you could argue that business could have fallen on its face. That's fine. Well, at least you know that. But what they did here instead is they didn't let the Warrior breathe. They gave him that half-ass program with Rick Rude. which was a reprisal of a feud that had already been blown off the previous year with the Warrior going over cleanly for the Intercontinental title.
Yeah.
It'd been one thing if the Warrior had never gotten his win back
right
from losing the Intercontinental title, but he did. And I remember as like a 9-10-year-old when this was like, I don't want to see this. And it was a they had actually wrestled on Saturday Night's Main Event, Ricky. You talk
right.
about before this, Warrior had gone over and they have a horrible... I mean, as good as the match was in 89, this match stinks in the cage. This is one of the worst cage matches you will ever see. But at the same time, Hogan got the big feud with Earthquake, who was the big lead heel after WrestleMania. Remember they did the famous angle on Brother Love where he
right.
took this, and my, you know, get well Hulkster and all that stuff. And that completely, that program completely overshadowed
it did.
The Warrior title reign. And by billing this as a double main event, it was sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that Warrior is not going to be as good as Hogan. I mean, even look moving forward to Survivor Series.
Yep.
They did the grand finale match of Survival. They both survived.
Mm-hmm.
So Warrior was done no favors. Look, Hogan deserves some of the credit for his feud with Earthquake being better than Warrior's program with Rude, just like Warrior deserves some of the blame. But the booking, you know, you talk about bad booking of your boy, Ronnie Garvin. All right, Warrior was done no favors by the booking here.
I'll tell you what, too, and looking up and down the card and then not presupposing that there were any big names left off of it, we keep saying, and you and I have said previously, okay, Warrior should have been in there with somebody better, some
I thought he should have
whatever.
Gotten Earthquake. Okay. I thought he should have gotten Earthquake.
But if they don't do that, who would he have been in there with exactly? Because I'm looking and it's like, they really didn't have, I mean, maybe you could have moved the DiBiase feud up. It ended up being a fall house show feud that was on Saturday night's main event. Outside of DiBiase,
I thought it had to be Earthquake.
Okay, but I guess that's what I'm saying. If you're saving Earthquake for Hogan.
I wouldn't have.
Okay, but
I'm saying,
were no real great answers, though. They're
Earthquake was the answer.
But I'm saying,
and I'm not saying that this would have been, you know, a good answer to Flair Steamboat with Warrior
right,
Earthquake
right,
on top.
Right.
But here's the thing, Ricky, and you remember you were
right.
watching at the time. They had unfinished business from the fall. Remember Earthquake when he debuted?
Right.
What's your name, John? Remember the push-up contest?
That's
with Tito
true.
Bravo?
Yeah.
It made a lot of sense.
Yeah.
To do Warrior Earthquake as your big summer feud, have it headline the show, and they gave the monster heel to Hogan. It's vintage Hogan hog the
yeah,
limelight
but,
booking. I don't like it. I don't endorse it.
How do you keep enough heat on Earthquake for when Hogan comes back?
Why does Hogan have to have Earthquake? Why? What birthright did he
well,
do?
Well, you're not going to put Hogan in there with the guy that injured him? I mean, right.
I'm
now,
saying
okay,
I wouldn't have done that angle.
Oh, okay.
I'm
no,
saying
no,
I wouldn't
right,
have
right,
done
all right, all right, all right.
I'm saying, now granted,
okay.
Hogan was...
All right, I'm with you.
Okay,
I'm with
sorry.
You.
Okay, I was
I'm with you.
Is there something in my face?
No, okay.
No, here's the thing. Now, granted, Hogan was a little more human,
right.
I think, and this is like really like nerd analysis
right.
here. So, like...
So, if somebody else put him out.
It would have been weird... Or I would have just had him go walk away. Like really? Like, I mean, he just kind of, like, they didn't do anything big with him in 88 when he went. I mean, granted, he had a movie. He had a
right.
real life commitment. But they didn't do a big angle to take him off TV
You're right.
then. And they did it for then, and he
okay.
really wasn't going away to do anything. Make another movie,
well,
man. Do something. But here's, now, it would have been interesting because the Warrior was kind of like this super, and this was part of the problem.
Yeah.
That would they have wanted him to sell like Hogan did for the Earthquake angle?
Probably not. No, and here's
but
the thing
wouldn't it
too.
Have been cool? Like, whoa, the Warrior's been put down. He's not going crazy anymore.
Well, how would you have done that and still had the 30-day rule for the champions with Hogan?
Jesus Christ!
It was, well,
I mean, for God's sake, Ricky,
are you
going to
call me? Are you going to call me Stu Sachs for
yes,
bringing that
yes,
up?
Yes, Stu.
Right.
Yes,
all right.
Really.
All right.
Really.
Well, just
really.
In terms of kayfabe.
Well, yeah.
How badly could you injure him and have him still be there for SummerSlam? But here's the thing too. I'm going to bring this up. What this show started, this is a deleterious trend in pro wrestling that was not around beforehand, and I believe plagues us to this very day.
Uh-oh.
And that being the double main event with the deposed big name looming larger than the belt. You didn't really have that, by and large, in wrestling. I mean, even Bruno Sammartino, when he would make his times coming back, whatever. Okay, him and Zbyszko headlined the third Shea Stadium show. I'll give you that. But Bruno Sammartino wasn't looming over the back of Bob Backlund. Or now, a couple of them collectively did. They would bring in Bruno and Andre and whatever. But, I mean, Once Hulk Hogan didn't have the belt, like you said, they didn't see it. You didn't see it in
the
88.
The focus of the promotion did not shift off of it.
Well, in 88, it was not an issue because he was soldered to Randy Savage. All right? SummerSlam, Survivor Series, whatever. You didn't see Savage without seeing Hogan. This thing here now, somebody not allied with Hogan, just a separate babyface, you have to go the double main event route, and you see that persisting in this business. The biggest egomaniac of all time.
They didn't need to call it a double main event. Why, Hogan, here's the thing. Let's say they don't listen to me and they still do this thing as is.
It is the elephant in the room, though, that Hulk Hogan is going to be considered a main event.
You don't need to reinforce.
I guess you're right, because Vern Gagne, the egomaniac that he is, retiring with the AWA World Heavyweight title. But here's my point. When he came back in the 80s and would tag with Greg Gagne against Sheik Adnan Al-Kasi's stable, that was not a main event. The main event of the show was Stan Hansen or Rick Martel or Nick Bockwinkle or Larry Zbyszko defending the World Heavyweight Championship.
That's what
even
I'm
Vern
saying.
Gagne didn't do that.
I know, but
you see it to this day. This whole thing, CM Punk's been champion for 200 days. Come on. He hasn't closed a show since, like, friggin' Survivor Series, if then. John Cena is the focus of the promotion, whatever. It's this Hoganitis that started in 1990 at SummerSlam 90 that persists to this day. It's a 2 decades-plus destructive blight on professional wrestling, Kyle Ross.
I thought that was a wonderful rant. And by the way, those are very interesting shirts you have on, by the way. I just noticed that. Go with your Ted DiBiase shirt.
Ted DiBiase, Million Dollar Man shirt, and jorts.
Yes.
interesting combo.
Interesting enough with Cena. Yeah. But no, you're right.
It
was an elephant in the room. And I just think, again, they just did the Warrior favors with the booking here. I'm not saying that would have mattered. Maybe it doesn't matter anyway.
Right.
But, I mean, this just was a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, and Hogan... And this is a thing where, okay, they were trying to milk it probably again for the house shows. He wins by countout? I mean,
that was very rare, too. I'm glad you brought that up. There was also some stuff, too, that we could just breeze by with the Big Boss Man was getting a big push, and he was in his corner against Bravo. You know, they almost should have just done a tag match.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Hogan and Boss Man versus Earthquake, you know, the tag. It would have continued the tag team theme we'd seen at SummerSlam. Yeah. They might as well have just done originally Tugboat Thomas, your boy, was going to be in his corner. But I think even Hogan was like, oh, God, like, you know, I've had Hillbilly Jim on my side before, but this guy just takes the cake.
Uncle Fred.
So he siphoned off the heat of the Boss Man, who was getting real hot.
Yeah.
And was doing double duty on this show, too. He was a special guest referee for the very... underwhelming Jake Roberts Bad News Brown match, the old snake sewer rat versus the sewer rat situation.
Yeah, this would, particularly when you look at the main event heel side, this was a thin period for the WWF in a boom period here. You just didn't have a lot. The fact that Boss Man was pulling double duty, the fact that Earthquake was like the only viable main event heel at this time, it didn't last long. But SummerSlam 90 was a period where it was like, based on guys that they'd already killed.
Warrior. Here's the thing, too. After the show,
he
had no one to feud with. You talk about, that was weak.
The thing with DiBiase,
that was weak.
All he was doing was the six-mans with the Road Warriors against Demolition.
Yeah.
That was like the fall program.
Yeah, and then they like kind of started a thing with Randy Savage, which, you know, was never even a pay-per-view match. See, Savage's cost was Slaughter.
Right.
You know, they did debut him, but he was on the show, I think, in a Brother Love segment, of all things, that he was going to be the big new fall heel that they'd build toward. So I think he was on this, and, you know, that was, at the time, that was considered, you know, very questionable by Vince McMahon, considering they had just started, I believe it was Desert Shield at this point as opposed to Desert Storm.
Yes. So they were going in that direction.
I have my military timeline now.
Yes, you are correct about
Desert
that.
Shield. So it was pretty offensive and pretty tasteless and, in retrospect, pretty bad.
Yeah, it was all of those things. Randy Savage, Dusty Rhodes, that was the blow off of their feud, and the start of the Dusty Rhodes DiBiase feud when DiBiase bought Sapphire.
That was bad.
Yeah,
that didn't work. You know, they had done the mixed tag, obviously Savage and Sherry jobbing to Rhodes and Sapphire at WrestleMania. This was kind of their way to get their heat back, and Rhodes firmly goes on the job squad after this.
Yep.
This is before Dustin came in and. Yeah, you're right, DiBiase. And that's another bad omission from this show.
Yeah.
DiBiase not in the ring. I mean, I'd rather have him wrestling somebody than buying Sapphire.
Oh, exactly. And you talk about how work rate meant nothing at this time. Nikolai Volkoff and Jim Duggan over the Orient Express.
This was the very ill-fated Nikolai Volkoff, you know, because I'm sure, you know, much to your chagrin, the Soviets were trying out democracy at the time. And, you know, so, of course, you know, Vince, wanting to mirror real life, had, you know, Jim Duggan reach out to Nikolai Volkoff, the former communist that the man was. And, you know, I believe they were called by the way, he makes a terrible American Express don't leave home without it joke before this match.
Yeah, and, you know.
Of course, they had to beat up foreigners to show that Nikolai Volkoff loved America.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, when I think reality, Vince McMahon's booking is the first thing that comes to my mind. So
there are some highlights on this show,
by the way. You told me off air.
And it's
this
not
was
the
a
Warlord
great
beating Tito Santana.
Well, Hart Foundation Demolition. Hart Foundation wins the title, best 2 out of 3 falls match in 14-24. The only thing I remember about that is LOD interfering to get them the win, but you said there was a good program leading up to this, an excellent one.
They had built, again, well-built title programs. I have really come to respect them, the ones back in the day, because now you don't do any well-built title programs.
Yep.
But they had the Hearts basically challenge the winner of Demolition Colossal Connection at WrestleMania 6.
Yep.
Demolition wins the belts for a third time as a babyface team. Axe, I believe, was beginning to have his health issues here. They, at the time, no one knew that, but at the time, inexplicably debuted the third member, Crush, in a demolition, had them turn heel, and they built this match 2 out of 3 falls. And the big draw was only 2 members of Demolition can wrestle in this match because they had done a Saturday Night's Main Event where they had kind of cheated to beat the Demolition, cheated to beat the Rockers using the third guy illegally coming in winning.
Yep.
So in the third fall, I liked this match a lot.
Was the WWF billing it as Freebird rules, where only two of the three could defend the belts?
No, they did not bill it. Now, they weren't calling it that, but basically that's what it was.
Yes.
But they were doing the... First of all, I didn't like how they claimed you couldn't tell the Demolition members apart. That led to the incredibly awful masked Demolition idea. But they were doing a cool thing where they were switching under the ring. Axe comes out in the third... Because it was Smash and Crush that worked the balance of the match.
Right.
Axe comes out in the third fall. They're doing the old switcheroo on him. LOD, like you mentioned, who had just signed, comes in, helps the Hearts win to what was supposed to kick off what was supposed to be a dream program between the LOD and Demolition. Didn't really turn out that way because Demolition was just kind of done. People still wanted to cheer for them. I remember being mad when they turned heel.
I
remember being like, I still like Demolition. Why am I supposed to boo them?
See, but that, again, I never had much regard for them as an NWA guy. I was all
I
about
liked
the Road
Demolition
Warriors.
A lot.
No, I was all about the Road Warriors. But the one thing, and this was very jarring, the dynamic of that feud was so weird. Road Warriors are the guys coming in from the outside and saying, you ripped us off. And that had to be very confusing for all the mouth-breathing WWF fans at the time. You're like, what are you talking about? We never heard of these guys, but Demolition's been here for 3 years. Odd dynamic.
I think it was because there were certain exceptions made. Now, granted, we'll talk when we get to 91. I know you'll complain about this again, but, you know, the Flares, the Road Warriors, there's certain guys that even Vince in this time period would kind of give a nod to. It's like, okay, we can't pretend this. No one knows who this is.
Okay.
The Road Warriors, I think, were on that very short list. There was another tag team match I want to talk about.
Yeah. Well, Power and Glory defeated the Rockers in 6 minutes exactly. Kind of a squasheroo, wasn't it?
Well, Michaels was hurt
in
this, and they do a big job, but here's why I want to talk about this. You can't watch this match and say Power and Glory was A, not in line for a big push, which they were, and B, didn't somewhat deserve it. They had the great powerplex, first of all.
That was a great finishing maneuver.
And one of the cool things I like about this match, and see, today, with John Cena's kind of ruined this. Mm-hmm. Like, remember there used to be a time period where it was so memorable when a baby face would get booed out of the building.
Yeah.
Like, it was like this big deal. Like, oh, my God. Like, is the company completely misreading did the unwashed masses all buy tickets to this show? Mm-hmm. This was in face-hating Philly, first of all. And the crowd really turns on the Rockers here. I mean, Power and Glory is getting much bigger face pop than probably they ever deserved in this year. And they go over real strong. And it's my understanding that they were in line to get the belts in the fall. The Hearts, who won that great match against Demolition later in the show, were to job to the Rockers.
Right.
Now, that match was erased from history when the rope broke, the old Phantom title change. That's been discussed ad nauseum before. And they were going to fire Neidhart. They didn't fire Neidhart. And Vince winds up signing the Nasty Boys. And the way that figures in is he kind of overpaid for them to jump ship from the NWA, and he's like, oh, God, I just paid a lot of money. These guys are going to get the belts. And Power and Glory then just kind of went to the JTTS squad.
Yeah.
But they just, you know, if you watch this match, and granted, I mean, Hercules and Paul Roma, I mean, who right. knows? They might have sucked, maybe. It was just, but they looked good here.
Yeah.
You can't watch this match and say they weren't in line, that they didn't kind of look like they were ready for a big push.
The whole was infinitely better than the sum of the parts. We can say that.
Yeah.
And again, though,
there was kind of a thing, too, with these teams where Power and Glory formed, if you remember.
Right.
It was a weird angle where Roma had been beaten up by somebody, and the Rockers like came down to check on him. He was like shoving him, and then it was weird.
Right.
And Hercules just randomly runs down, and they just beat him up.
Well, let me just say this, too. And again, Young Stallions, you know, a friggin' awful name, okay? But him and Powers, again, they were JTTS, but they could work fairly decently well. And Roma's tag team with Paul Orndorff later in WCW and Arn
Anderson,
not
a bad team.
Not bad.
That was why I hated
Paul
him.
Roma.
I didn't like him. The Indiana,
well,
Anderson.
I hated him in the Horseman, but I mean him and I
liked him in Paul Orndorff. That was
right.
The thing is,
I mean,
there was a lot of stench attached to Roma at the time because he had been
right,
miscast
right,
as a Horseman.
But I mean, if you just look at the tag teams he was in. None of them are awful.
No,
none
and this,
of them
I mean,
are.
And granted, Hercules was badly in need of a fresh
right.
coat of paint at
right.
that point. I mean, he had completely been exhausted as a babyface.
Right.
But it worked okay. I mean, it was, like I said, they had a cool finishing move. The name was kind of cool.
There's a guy that kept finding a way to reinvent himself. You know, here he was in 1990 and had that. 2 years later, he's got a mask on, a super invader, and ends up winning PWI Rookie of the Year.
A buddy of mine, Chad Repak, claims that he was not Rookie of the Year that year. I think he saw, I don't know if he was looking. I think he
Interesting.
Thinks, yeah, I don't know.
I may have to take this up with the Metal Maniac.
Okay.
I'll have to go to an indie show sometime
okay.
and look up the Metal Maniac and argue
okay,
with him.
Okay, maybe the Metal, you The Metal, but yeah, it goes to show, never believe anything from him.
Yeah. The one other match we didn't talk about here, we alluded to it during the previous mini-episode
yes.
here.
Okay, good.
That Brutus Beefcake displaced in a storyline in 1988 from the Intercontinental title match, displaced by a act of God from the storyline in 1990, a parasailing accident, as I understand
with
it.
With Brian Blair was
yes,
there.
Yes, on
Killer Bee's fame.
Yes, Independence Day 1990. Some woman's, knee came into his face from, 50 feet away or something like that, and
it
shattered
was
every bone in his face.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously a lot of people know that about Beefcake's face, and this basically ruined
Harley
his career.
Race never did that much damage to anybody with a high knee lift.
Yeah, yeah, really. Gee, come on now. But that essentially ruined his career.
Yeah.
He never, I mean, he came back and worked, you know, in 93 with Hogan. But after this, he essentially was a Hogan lackey.
I'll tell you what. And
his WCW run was atrocious. But
in fairness to Beefcake, who, like Harley Race, is a past Lounge guest, in fairness to him, I'll tell you what.
He had really improved by this point.
Exactly. And the amount of pain that anybody would be in after having anything like that happen, let me tell you something. In all humility, and I'm not a guy given to the substances, I think I would be causing an anthrax scare in a phone booth if I had that level of pain visited on me.
But, you know, he had gotten a lot better. You know, Beefcake, it was kind
of... He improved.
You kind of feel bad for the guy because he was supposed to go over here.
Right.
And he had... Now, granted, part of the reason he had looked a lot better over the last years, he'd been working largely with Randy Savage and Curt Hennig.
Right.
Which is going to make anyone look really good, no matter how, you know, bad you are in the ring. But he had improved enough. From 88 to 90, that was definitely the height of Brutus Beefcake. If you want,
right.
I mean, no one's going to make a DVD about it, but it was his height. And luckily for the second, now granted, they had a storyline in place in 88 with the Warrior.
Right.
Here, they kind of had a big name they had just signed that worked out great with the Texas Tornado, Kerry Von Erich.
Yep.
Who, again, big enough name from what a lot of people knew, the Von Erich family. Now they call him the Texas Tornado.
It was like a half nod at the beginning to who he was. Not a full-fledged nod.
I think they kind of talked about that he came from a good family. But, I mean, they didn't. Obviously, they weren't talking about, you know, his great matches with Ric Flair, you know, 9 years previous.
You know, Jesse, that was a great match at Texas Stadium in 1984.
Yeah.
You weren't hearing
any
of that.
You weren't hearing former NWA champion. But he was a big name. I remember I was pretty excited. Because I liked World. I'd watched World Class on ESPN, and I was pretty psyched. And it was cool to see him come in and beat Perfect. You know, thankfully, cooler heads prevailed, and Perfect gets the title win back because Kerry was a complete disaster behind the scenes. A few months later, Hennig wins the belt back. But this worked okay. It was a real short match, too. I mean, Henning really put the tornado over.
5:15.
It was real
that
short
one there. Yeah. So
two big names though. Two former world champions.
They were two big names. So I think that's about it for the card. I mean, not as good as 89. Not as bad as 88.
I'll be honest with you. I think this is one of the worst SummerSlams too. I was prepared. The two of the first three, 88, 90, are probably your two worst SummerSlams.
This one's downright program-rific compared to 88, though. Does it get any points for that?
Because of the tag title match, I'll give it the nod over 88.
Okay.
Because the tag title match is very good. It's like a 3.5, 4-star match in that range. But 89 is clearly the class of the first three.
Okay.
And as we move forward, until we get to like the mid-90s where there was just nothing underneath, forget about having programs. There's just no decent characters to even care about.
Yep.
This is one of the worst summers. This was a bad time. 1990 was a bad year.
Let's end this one with me giving you a good laugh here. I was just reading in one of the online dirt sheets. I think it might have been Lords of Paste. An interview with, I believe his name is Nelson Frazier, the former Viscera, the former Mabel, etc., claims that he would have won at SummerSlam 95 except for that darn click getting in Vince's ear. Your thoughts?
More on that in a later podcast.
The look of exasperation on your face is awesome. And with that, we bring it around. Thank you for tuning in to mini episode 147.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.